You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with Rachel Swirsky. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robinson.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is a segment in which Dave and I have the amazing honor to share the microphone with some really, really fabulous people. And today is one of the tops. This is one of those that I'm really, really excited about. Not that I'm not with all of them, but this one is pretty special.
Me too. Yes. Absolutely. And so let us get on with the introduction of our esteemed guest host for this episode. Brian, the first and foremost thing you need to understand about our guest host is she got her first million words out of the way in her youth, writing pages and pages of Star Trek fan fiction, which instantly establishes her geek cred beyond all doubt.
Completely.
She has an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop and attended the Clarion West Writers' Workshop as well. She's worked as both an editor and a writer, and has published more than 50 short stories since 2006 in venues including Subterranean Magazine, Weird Tales, Fantasy Magazine, and Subterranean Magazine, as well as several digital imprints including Tor.com and Clark's World. Her work has been collected in years' best anthologies, several of them, edited by Rich Horton, Jonathan Strahan, and the Vandermeers. Now, the cool thing about our guest host, one of the many, is that she's donated her writing to a number of charity anthologies. And her work has appeared alongside the likes of Peter Straub, Patrick Rothfuss, John Scalzi, and Catherine M. Valente, supporting such charities as Pro-Literacy and the Lupus Alliance of America. Her work has been nominated for the Hugo Award, the World Fantasy Award, the Locus Award, the Sturgeon Award, and the Million Writers Award. In 2011, her novella, The Lady Who Plucked Red Flowers Beneath the Queen's Window, won the Nebula Award. And this year, her work, Fields of Gold, has been nominated for a Hugo in the Best Novelette category. Ladies and gentlemen, it is our distinct pleasure to invite to the large chair at the round table the Vice President of the Sci-Fi and Fantasy Writers of America, Rachel Swirsky. Rachel, holy smokes, I can only imagine the heaping plate of goodness that is your schedule. So we really appreciate you coming in and spending some time with us. Thank you.
I actually really love talking about craft and especially talking to writers who are, getting a grip on craft and things like that. And so it's a pleasure for me to be able to do this.
Excellent. Then let's get into it. I'm going to go ahead and set the timer for 20 minutes. We will, of course, ignore it. We have yet to actually stop the timer at 20 minutes, but let's lead in with our first question. Rachel, one of the things that strikes me, one of the many things that strikes me about your career and your craft is that it's almost exclusively short fiction. I don't think you've actually written anything longer than a novella. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. About 60,000 words into a novel. They're really, really long. And I have an attention span problem. I know that some writers finish everything they start. I'm like the opposite of that. Some writers work on one project until they're done. I work on a million projects and I'm always doing a new thing. And so a new idea occurs to me and I have trouble like being like, well, now I'm going to stay with the old idea for 100,000 words.
That's awesome. See, now I think that's a huge affirmation for every writer who has ever shared that same, I need to do this, I need to do this, I need to do that. Yep. But you've actually, I mean, you clearly have finished several, many works of short fiction. And I was wondering if you would sing the praises, the siren song of short fiction, and what it means to you and why it is, other than attention deficit disorder, why it's the format that you have chosen to express yourself through.
Well, one of the other reasons I end up with short fiction more than novels is that I'm incredibly obsessive about language. So I also write poetry. And the good thing about short forms is you can be incredibly obsessive about language. You can really obsess over every word. And my revision style is incredibly unproductive. I actually retype on the story as many as 16 times.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, I don't go in and just change a few lines. I actually do that, and that's increasingly prohibitive with length. So at 100,000 words, you have to give up some of that control, and it's great that people do, but that was one of the first pieces of advice I got at the Iowa Writers Workshop when I was in a novel class with Sam Chang was, well, you realize if you're going to do this, you have to give up some control. And I was like, no, I have control. So with short stories, you can be really obsessed about language. You can have a lot of control. There's more tolerance in the short story media for being experimental. There are certainly experimental novels, although there are fewer of them in genre than I think there are outside of genre. And I like the suddenness of short fiction. You can be really intense with it. And things that wouldn't work over a larger span, which is one of the reasons why experimentalism is more tolerated in short fiction, is sometimes you can do things that work in 3,000 words that would get really tedious over 100,000 words.
Sure.
The second person, for instance, I actually really like. And you can do a novel in second person, but I think it's a little easier to take in a smaller chunk.
Okay.
Definitely.
Now, you say that you retype your works up to 16 times, and I'm wondering if you can articulate and share with our listeners what it is that each of those retypes and recreations is doing for you in terms of discovering that true voice or that ultimate expression of the story that you're working on.
Well, I think there are several things, you know, especially as the drafts change. I do some structural shuffling and things like that. I think I actually do less of it than a lot of other writers do. I find that particularly for scenes where you're revealing character through dialogue, it becomes easier for me to deepen character and both character expression, character development, and also the way that they're speaking and the way they're moving. As I go through the scene multiple times, it's easier for me to find different layers in there to see where the dialogue is coming out as my voice instead of their voices, and things like that. So that's sort of a first layer. I also retype because it allows you to really reevaluate all the word choices you're making. I don't always use them, but I do also like using longer sentences and heavier vocabulary. And I think that doing that is incredibly tricky because you still want it to read very easily. Mm-hmm. And you want the clauses to flow very easily into each other and into the next sentence so that the reader preferably doesn't have to pause, doesn't have to reread. And so making sure that the sentences are really well organized on that level is important to me. And then I think there's a little bit of obsessiveness that I probably could cut out. And that's one of the things I'm trying to learn to do is to say, no, actually, I don't have to retype this and only change, you know, a few phrasings and a few words.
Okay.
And probably gone. Yeah.
And real quick, just out of curiosity, do you, as part of your editorial process, do you read your work aloud to check for editorial glitches along the way?
Usually, I used to do it a lot more. But I do still do it, and it does help you catch where, you know, you've left a weird bit of a clause dangling and things like that.
Okay. That was mostly a point of curiosity. We've had several authors on who have advocated that process, and I sort of an informal poll of how widely used is that particular editorial
right
item.
It's a really good idea. I'm using it less, and, the only guess I might have for why that might be the case is I know that some writers, or that there are like a couple different reading styles, and I'm pretty sure I have the reading style where I actually hear the voice in my head.
Okay.
Which might make it a little bit less necessary sometimes for me to speak it aloud as well.
Sure, sure.
Do you feel that slows you down at all in the writing process? To hear it?
I don't think so. I also think that retyping sometimes serves the same purpose as reading it aloud, because it does force me to look at every word carefully.
Sure, by the 10th or 12th time, sure, I can see that backing you up. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Four or six occasionally.
I want to go in a little bit of a side direction. After reading A Monkey Will Never Be Rid of Its Black Hands, which I loved, by the way, and there's something that I see in spec fic all the time that as a genre, it relies so heavily on the willing suspension of disbelief from the reader. And I was with you the entire way. I bought everything in the entire story. How do you find that line between trusting your audience will follow along faithfully versus feeling the need to explain and prove so that you don't lose your audience's willing suspension of disbelief? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that that's not usually been what I think about, although I actually, in literary workshops, they talk about speaking with authority, because even though we talk about suspension of disbelief as a genre thing, and it does come in that way, even in stories that are realistic, you have to be establishing a sense of confidence in the reader that you know what you're talking about. And so really solidifying your voice can help with that. Use of specific details and other things that we usually talk about as prose issues can make it clear to the reader that you know what's going on. I think for me, it's also clarity. A lot of times when I get really irritated with something that doesn't feel realistic, it's because the author is sort of murkily, doesn't know exactly where they're going, doesn't know how to release information, which I think is the big challenge of genre fiction as opposed to literary fiction, is that we have to deal with all the exposition and information release.
How do you deal with that? I mean, that you're absolutely right. That's, you know, I think all of us that are still in our first million words are confronted with that. How do you find yourself running into that at all? And how do you address that in your own process?
The first major step for me, and I wish I could explain more how this process had worked. It wasn't very articulated for me. A lot of it just happened by instinct as I kept going. But
sure.
The first major step for me was making sure that readers could understand the story, like, at all. and workshops are really useful for that. You know, you bring it in, and there was a story that I've been trying to write for about 16 years now. And someday, I think it will be a novel. And I brought it into one of my first workshop classes, and everyone was like, this is gorgeous. It's such a gorgeous metaphor. And I was like, metaphor for what? No, that's all literal.
Oops. Disconnect.
So, like, yeah, you sort of like hear what people's responses are. And I think it's sometimes important to end up with readers who aren't like your readers, because my readers, like, you know, the people who know me really well or the people who are on exactly my page, they know what I'm talking about. But you need to find people who are a little bit, you know, away from you aesthetically, or who don't know you, particularly people who don't know you, and make sure that they can follow it as well.
Okay.
My rule is that I want my mother, who's a highly educated person who reads all the time, but is not very sophisticated literarily in some ways, like she doesn't think about theme and stuff like that when she's reading, sure, to be able to follow what I'm doing.
Okay.
So just comprehension generally is one of the most important steps. Sorry, kittens are attacking my skirt.
Ow, blood is drawn. This may be the first time blood was drawn on the Roundtable Podcast. Holy crap.
It won't may be not the be last. The
Yes, indeed. And is your mother available as a beta reader for other... No, I'm joking.
I actually don't use her as a beta reader very often anymore, but I've got an instinct for it now. I can usually tell. But I did develop that instinct by throwing it at people and being like, hey, do you understand what the hell is going on here? And then figuring out how to release information. I think there's the Orson Scott Card thing where he says, don't hold your cards too close to your chest.
Sure.
Don't be deliberately obfuscatory to try to, like, you know, make pacing work better. One of the things that really made sense to me was when I was at Clarion, Michael Swanwick said, you know, if you've got a whole chunk of different things that the author, that the reader is going to have to swallow all at once, this is suspension of disbelief and exposition. Like, you've got a time traveling lesbian vampire who's come back in time to have sex with herself. A specific example.
I would read that story, but yeah.
I believe it's published. I can figure out where it is at some point. It's by Eugene Myers, E.C. Myers.
Oh, right.
He had spent like 5 pages being like, well, she's time traveling and also a vampire and a lesbian and so on, and sort of going, you know, step by step. And Michael Swanwick was like, there's no reason you can't just do this in one sentence. The time traveling lesbian vampire arrived at the bar.
Right.
Because
That's
every
brilliant.
Time there was a new thing, there was a new thing for the reader to go like, yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then now, you spend the rest of the story evolving and supporting that opening statement.
Right. And so sometimes I think we trip ourselves up with the release of information, and we could just do it a little bit like, here's some information, let's move on.
Sure. We'll be back with more of our conversation with Rachel Swirsky after this brief promotional break.
My name is Justin McCumber. I'm the creator and one of the co-hosts for the Dead Robots Society podcast. Every week, we discuss a variety of topics that are fundamental to the craft of writing, from the differences between tone and theme, to world building, to how to create compelling antagonists. Along with the roundtable discussions, we've also had the pleasure of interviewing published authors, television writers, podcast luminaries, publishing house founders, and magazine editors. We're dedicated to our listeners, and we work hard to pack our episodes with as much quality education and entertainment as possible. We never stop encouraging ourselves and our listeners to always be writing and to always be improving. The promised land of publication is our goal, and we know that together we can achieve it. If we can also have a good laugh along the way, all the better. You can find us online at www.deadrobotssociety.com. At our website, you'll find show notes, links to our personal sites, our email address, and direct download links to our episodes. You'll also find a link to our forums, where we've created a private critique group so that you can safely post your work and get comments and suggestions from us as well as our listeners. All we ask is that you participate by critiquing in return. So come to our site, subscribe to our show, and join us. You can also find us at iTunes. Just search for Dead Robots and we'll be there. After that, get writing. We are.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Rachel Swirsky.
Now, as a process, because you have an amazing command of language, and you've said that you enjoy language and that you, you know, you appreciate it. And a lot of people who love and appreciate language have a hard time not becoming overly flowery in their narrative. And you're very clear and concise in the writing that I've read of yours, at least. So does that trip you up at all to sort of, you have to kind of pull yourself back if you love the language too much?
Is the first draft more lyric, right, and more descriptive than the final draft?
Occasionally. I really feel like, for me, characters developed through language. So how the character wants to talk is often the way that the prose will come out. So a character like in One in a Monkey Will Never Be Rid of Its Black Hands is not going to tell you something lyrical ever. He would rather die than tell you something lyrical. And I have another story called A Memory of Wind with a Greek character who speaks much more lyrically. So, you know, for her, I probably had to pull back some to get to something a little bit more comprehensible. And there's still some sort of mysterious passages in there that I know what they mean.
You got to keep one or two of those for yourself.
I actually think that, and this might not sound intuitive, poetry is what totally gave me, like, the skills to be able to make things both pretty in language and also concise and concrete. Sure. What prose writers tend to think poetry is this sort of flowery, like, let's use long words, because we get excited about long words, they're fun. But when you're writing poetry, you have to make sure every word's the right word. You don't actually tend to use abstract words, you use very specific, concrete words that connect to specific, concrete images. And so I actually suggest poetry classes as a way for people who are looking to develop prose skills.
Sure. Well, you have an extensive body of work in the poetry field. In fact, you took third place in the Riesling Award.
Yeah, in the Riesling.
Yeah. So that's actually excellent advice. I'm not sure a lot of prose writers would go that route. But yeah, write a poem. See how that feels, and then apply that cadence.
See what the poets actually think.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you want to be a good football player, take ballet.
Right. Even if you're not doing good poetry, like, you can see what the actual poets are doing.
Sure.
Playwriting is great for, like, you know, thinking about when you don't have all those narrative tools, when you can't make the moment stop as easily, when you can't just describe things and go into the character's voice. And I think that working in different genres gives you immense power and tools to bring back.
That's excellent advice. That's excellent advice.
It's fabulous.
Let me ask you about your experience both at Clarion West and Iowa Writers Workshop. Brian and I are relative newcomers to both the podcasting world and, well, maybe not to writing, but even in the short time that we've been consuming the writer's craft side of things, Clarion West and Iowa Writers continues to come up as the place where writers go to truly test their craft. And can you speak a little bit about what it is about those particular workshops and events that make them so powerful and transformative?
Yeah, and to some extent, they're different. They're both sort of terminal in their field. Like, if you want to be a science fiction writer, like, you know, going to Clarion is sort of the terminal workshop experience. I don't mean that it kills you, although it's okay. And then, you know, Iowa Writers Workshop is similar. Clarion, as you guys know, is 6 weeks in a house with 17 strangers. And it's like the first 6 weeks of college where you go to the dorm and then you're like, I've known all of you all my life. Seems so much more heightened. And in some classes, everyone's having sex with each other. Not me. just being there in that environment, it's incredibly high pressure. You're writing a story a week. You're critiquing three stories a day. You have a different teacher each week. It forces you to sort of step out of your normal life and step into this really hot house environment. And some people need to take a break afterward because it's just exhausting.
I bet.
But I think that intensity is a major thing. I work with a lot of newer writers, or I try to, and sometimes they get stuck. There'll be people who I have no issue believing they will eventually be great, successful writers, but they get blocked somewhere. And something like Clarion West and its intensity can sort of help them get past that block, where whatever it is they're just not understanding, it sort of cause those subconscious processes to happen a little faster.
It sounds like a creative sweat lodge, like a spirit quest that you literally remove yourself from everything that you know and everything that you're comfortable with and are thrust into this pressure cooker of creative mojo. It sounds amazing.
It was totally amazing for me. It was much more transformative than my experience at the Iowa Writers Workshop, probably partially because I did it first.
Sure.
But also Iowa... I mean, no one can maintain that pace, I hope. Maybe somebody can, in which case, awesome. For 2 years. And Iowa's a 2-year-long program. The writers I went to Clarion West with were amazing. And, you know, you've probably heard of some of them. Kat Rambo, she's fantastic. And Katie Sparrow was up for the Nebula this year. E.C. Myers had a YA book published this year. I love them all. But actually, I was shocked because I started a different MFA program. I had applied after college. I didn't think I was very good at writing. I mean, I thought I was okay. So I didn't really, like, the Iowa Writers Workshop wasn't something I thought I could get into. So I went to an MFA program in Oakland, and it was right after Clarion West, and I was like, wow, I'm not going to do this. I was like, it's not that you can't get valuable advice from people who aren't as good at writing as you are, because you totally can. But I didn't really want to teach anybody grammar.
Oh.
And there were plenty of talented people, but it was not the Clarion West. And I was like, I don't want to do this. And my teacher said, well, I went to Iowa. You could probably get into Iowa. And I was like, really? So then I went to Iowa. And it was a really different experience for me. I was used to sort of always being at least in the top third of different classes and stuff. And I don't think I was when I was at Iowa. It probably depends on what metric you were using. Genre people can plot and sometimes lit people can't. But like the prose that people were producing was stunning. And there were people there who'd already done the Stegner Fellowship and stuff, which is a prestigious program that Stanford offers for beginning to mid-career writers. It was really amazing to see how they were working with and thinking about fiction. I was much more, I think, aligned aesthetically and like process-wise with a lot of the Clarion West people. And so it was a very different environment to see people who were thinking about things very differently, who weren't really worrying about publication necessarily, who were thinking more about art than readership. There are things that I really don't agree with. I like to think about the reader. That's very central to my process. But, you know, having the pushback on those things, having people say, well, yeah, of course you take 6 to 10 years to write a novel. That's how long it takes to finish something great. Instead of, well, you take 6 months to write a novel because that's when your next deadline is.
Right.
Was a really different experience for me.
Can we talk about that for just a second? The notion of you writing for your reader. We've asked this question once or twice of other authors, and right. I'm intrigued by the fact that you actually have a reader in mind when you're writing. Can you describe that individual and how it is that they impact your writing as in your process?
Well, I mean, I don't know how specific it is. Occasionally it gets really specific. Like, I just wrote an Alice in Wonderland parody that I'm in love with. And obviously the reader for that has to be somebody who is going to be interested in catching lots of Alice in Wonderland references. So that's a more limited audience. Talking about my mother as a reader, making sure that, you know, it's something that she can understand and enjoy is sort of basic. But it also, it changes from story to story. One other way to explain it, I guess, is occasionally, like, I want to write a story for feminist audiences. And okay. So then I wouldn't spend as much time building up, like, what I think they already know as I might if I was writing it with the expectation that people totally unfamiliar with the politics of social justice were going to be reading it.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. So you're not building the Rachel Swirsky brand specifically. You're each piece that you create comes from some desire to articulate something from the inside, and then you pick the audience that it's going to go to and you write to that audience. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I feel like I'm talking to people. And if I didn't feel like I was talking to people, I probably wouldn't write. I know there's kind of this like abstract idea of the writer who writes only for themselves and they would write only in their journal even if no one looked at it. And you know, I started out in acting, like, and I was trying to think the other day, like, does anybody ever say, well, I act only for myself, act only in my living room? I mean, like, it's to me, it's a very participatory process. It's about talking to people. And I know that it's not that way for everybody.
Right. Everybody's got their own style. And Brian, did you catch that? She's an actress.
I know, right?
There are so many actors who have become writers. Yeah. What's that about? Rachel, can you just, we're almost out of time, but what do you think that's about?
I mean, like attention? No. Well, I think that the skills of different creativities, it's not like they're not different, like, but they're somewhat linked. Like there's a way of talking about emotional expression and wanting to channel that into communicating with people. You know, I stopped writing for about 6 months a couple of years ago. I was sick and I was like, all right, I need to make sure that this is what I really want to do with my life. And it's frustrating me right now. So I'm just going to take some time off. And I was making jewelry and I was like, this is amazing. This is a craft you can finish. Because it takes
it's tangible.
A piece of art, right? A piece of writing. It takes me so long to finish. And by the time I finished it, I was, you know, finished that 6 months. I was designing these incredibly elaborate pieces of jewelry, narratives behind them. So I feel like there's just sometimes that energy can be channeled from one art to another.
Excellent. Excellent.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I hate to say it, but the clock has wound down and it always flees the room entirely too quickly. So to sum up, writers, try writing some poetry, take an acting class, definitely look at Clarion West for that vibe of thing, or Iowa Writers Workshop or something along those lines so that you can share your work with others that don't know you, and beware of kittens while you're recording. Yeah.
And know your audience.
And know your audience, yes, and write to your audience.
Yes.
Rachel, holy smokes, this has been golden.
Gold.
Thank you so much for making the time and sharing so generously with our audience. We really appreciate that.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. Okay. Brian, closing thoughts as we jeté off to Coolsville with yet another 20 minutes with?
Yeah, I just am really excited that you came on, and I'm very, very seriously considering making you required reading for my creative writing class.
Oh, absolutely.
So I may have to, like, shoot you an email and, you know, work out the logistics
of
that.
If you have not read The Lady Who Plucked Red Flowers Beneath the Queen's Window, make
I'm already writing it down.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It is gorgeous. It is lush. All right, friends. Thank you so much for tuning in. We always appreciate you downloading and hitting that play button. As always, if you want to show us some love, spread the word. Let the world know that this is going on. If you enjoyed this episode, swing out to iTunes, drop a comment up on the website, shoot us an email and say, yaha, or hey, you forgot to ask Rachel something, at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. And do stay tuned, because in just a few short days, we'll have Rachel back, and she'll be workshopping a very cool story by something of a podcast celebrity from the day.
Yes.
But until then, Brian, any suggestions?
Go write.
Poetry.
Sure. Go read poetry. Go yes. Take a poetry class. And then go write beautiful prose.
Yes. Awesome. Yeah. And friends, you find what you're looking for. So by all means, look for wow. Look for amazing. And I promise you, you will find it. Stay tuned in a couple of days. We'll be back. But until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.